Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to have with me today, I think for the first time, definitely for the first time, in fact, an otolaryngologist, Dr. Alexander, goes by Zandy, Hillel. Dr. Hillel is the is an associate professor of otolaryngology, actually with a joint appointment in anesthesiology. He's also the residency director for the otolaryngology residency program here at Johns Hopkins, and he joins us today to talk about anesthesia and surgery around tracheostomies, as well as a couple other interesting things that we'll get the ENT perspective on from him. Zandy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jed.
And I want to point out that this episode is going to be featured on anesthesiologynews.com. Listeners will know they feature our episodes from time to time. So check it out over there. Let us know if you see it, anesthesiologynews.com. They've got a lot of other great stuff you can check out while you're over there. All right, let's jump in. Zandy, I want to start very basically and ask you, we'll talk about tracheostomies, and let me just ask you, what is that? When we say a tracheostomy, let's just go to the basics in case anybody doesn't know. What is a tracheostomy?
Sure thing, Jed. A tracheostomy is an airway prosthesis that goes in through the neck into the trachea below the vocal cords. That's the simple, there are a lot of reasons for it, but that's the simple explanation of what it is.
Great. And how does that differ from a cricothyrotomy?
So a cricothyrotomy is, we use the same equipment. It's also done through the neck, but the cricothyrotomy is, I would say 99% of the time done as an emergency procedure as part of the difficult airway algorithm when bag masking fails, the ability to intubate fails. And the cricothyrotomy is unique in that the incision and the tube is going through the cricothyroid space, which is the a space that on most patients is very palpable, and you can access it quickly in an emergency setting.
And what is it about that that makes it not an ideal choice for a non-emergency setting? In other words, why don't we just do cricothyrotomies on everybody? Why did patients get tracheostomies instead?
The big reason for this is its proximity to the vocal cords. And depending on the individual patient's anatomy, the tracheostomy tube the cricothyrotomy tube, if it stays in that position, can actually cause injury to the vocal folds. So we therefore like to have these more semi-permanent or sometimes even permanent tracheostomies further away from the vocal folds so as to limit potential injury to them and allow the patient to use their vocal folds to phonate or to speak to generate voice later on in their care.
Great. All right. So the tracheostomy is done inferior to the cricothyroid ligament, and it's done at any certain level. Is it always tracheal ring number two? Or
yeah, I think that as we as a general rule, we like to stay at least one ring away from the cricoid. You know, I think you'll hear some people say they like to be between rings two and three, but I think anywhere between one and two and three, some people probably even go to between three and four.
Great. All right. And what are different ways to do this? I personally have participated, and a lot of our anesthesia colleagues out there will have participated in percutaneous tracheostomies. I'm sure there's also open tracheostomies. Are there other, or are those the two main techniques?
Those are the two main techniques. There's probably some hybrid versions of that, although they would still be a percutaneous tracheostomy just done in the operating room, you know, using that technique.
Right. And is there – when would you use one versus the other?
Well, so as an otolaryngologist, I'm primarily called in for the open tracheostomies, although a number of my colleagues do perform percutaneous tracheostomies as part of the percutaneous tracheostomy team here at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I think probably the better way to think about it is percutaneous tracheostomies have gained a lot of favor because they are less expensive. They don't require transport of what are oftentimes critically ill patients. And they can avoid the difficulty of obtaining OR time,
yep,
which is usually in high demand. And then, therefore, patients can be treated sooner so that the tracheostomy can be placed sooner through a percutaneous technique.
Great. Now, when we think about an emergency cricothyrotomy, that is almost always a patient who is close to dying. That's why they're getting it. They can't get an airway. And so they're unlikely to be fully awake. But awake tracheostomies are done.
Yeah.
You want to say a word about that? When would you do an awake tracheostomy?
So awake tracheostomies are generally done in the case of an obstruction of the airway, usually at the level of the vocal folds. Squamous cell carcinoma of the larynx is probably the most common cause. In certain cases, some people who have bad intubation trauma to their vocal folds where the vocal cords don't open, posterior glottic stenosis or laryngeal stenosis, may also benefit from an awake tracheostomy simply because the managing team, the anesthesia team, and usually the otolaryngology team don't feel like you can safely place an endotracheal tube through the vocal folds or through the obstruction of the vocal folds.
Right. And so we think, therefore, it's not safe to put them to sleep. Therefore, you do it away.
Right. And I guess the third time that I would think about it would be in a trauma to the laryngeal cartilages, penetrating trauma, such as a gunshot wound.
Okay. Now, when we think about from our end, from the anesthesia side, what do you need? What role do we play when we're working with you on, let's start with a percutaneous tracheostomy?
So I guess in a percutaneous tracheostomy situation, we're working very closely.
Yeah.
There's obviously the sedation component that anesthesia is managing. In addition, in many situations, most percutaneous tracheostomy is felt to be more safely performed with bronchoscopy mm-hmm. to verify position. And that is, in most cases, performed by the anesthesiologist. So it's really a dual role where anesthesia is, in addition to providing the sedation and the general anesthesia, they are also having an assistant surgical role as well.
Great. So we're going in with the bronch through presumably what is already an endotracheal tube.
An endotracheal tube, yep.
Looking for your needle coming into the trachea, showing you that so you know where you are.
Right.
And then kind of working closely to slowly withdraw the tube while you're coming in with your new tracheostomy tube. When we think about paralysis, is that something that you like that for those percutaneous tracheostomies? In general, do you think surgeons want to have those patients relaxed? Is it a very individual decision? Does it matter?
Yeah, I would probably I don't know that it's necessary. Certain cases, I generally like paralysis if the vocal folds might be involved. So I think it depends on how awake the patient is mm-hmm. and how active they are. But I think it would probably be a surgeon preference.
Okay. And if you're doing it awake, is it done under just local? Do you just infiltrate lidocaine in the area?
Generally, yeah. I mean, if you feel, you know, what you're also relying on is, well, what happens if something untoward or unexpected happens? And so sometimes anesthesia might be there providing some high flow oxygen or even some supportive breathing. In that situation, it's kind of an all hands on deck. It is done quite quickly, but under control. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, different from a cricothyrotomy, which is really just about getting in as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
So in that situation, anesthesia is, I think in all three of these situations, right, it really is a team effort with close communication.
Yeah.
But an awake tracheostomy is one where you sort of have to anticipate both. Both physicians, both teams need to anticipate that something unexpected could happen and need to work in concert if that is the case.
Yeah, great. Now, there's some folks out there who are in anesthesia but are going to be at times, or there may be folks in emergency medicine who will be at times performing a cricothyrotomy in an emergency situation. When I was a resident, I was taught to do essentially a Seldinger technique. With a needle, then a wire, then a, there's kits that do this. There's certainly been some papers recently in the past few years in the emergency medicine literature that kind of advocate for not doing it that way, for doing I think what they refer to as a finger bougie technique, or finger scalpel bougie. When you do it, are you all using some sort of kit that is with a needle and a wire and a dilator, or how are you doing your percutaneous tricks?
Oh, percutaneous tricks.
Yes, percutaneous
okay.
tricks.
So yeah, usually,
or I guess I should say crikes.
Oh, crikes. Well, so to me, a crike is truly an emergency. It is a a true emergency, you probably have some small number of minutes or less than a minute to get an airway in.
Right.
And it is I don't rely on a kit. I would ask for a knife, or hopefully we've anticipated that this, you know, that our airway management may end up at the last step in the difficult airway algorithm.
Right.
And we would have a knife available. Hopefully you may have even injected some local lidocaine with epinephrine to limit any bleeding.
Yep.
And then it's a quick palpate for the cricoid, almost a puncture technique or a quick slash.
With a scalpel
to try and immediately get into the airway.
Okay.
You're relying on all of your senses. I mean, there was a case that I had where I made a big vertical incision, and it was the air whoosh that we heard in a patient who was obstructed that gave us the positive feedback that we had gotten into the airway.
Yeah.
And then it was a matter of just placing a tube through there. So, Okay. You know, we talk about technique, and I think technique is important. It's more important in the surgical decision making. And I think that's what's so hard when you have physicians who aren't usually operating with a scalpel.
Right.
One, there's the recognition of how quickly do you need to act. I mean, I remember we were in the interventional radiology suite, and I took a look at the anesthesiologist who was there. Thankfully, we had our difficult airway cart. We took one look at each other, and we were like, we can't bag mass this patient. We need to move to a surgical airway. And that was very helpful because it was, you know, both of the physicians sort of realized that and worked in concert. So, but sometimes, it doesn't always go as expected. And really the bottom line is you have to get into the airway in a fashion to then ventilate the patient.
Right. So often you're going to go for speed over, kind of any kind of exact technique. You just want to get in there with the knife. Does vertical versus horizontal?
Yeah, I think that probably is worth discussing. The benefit of a vertical incision through the neck is you're going to generally avoid any medium or large size vessels. If you make a horizontal incision, I've seen some where the great vessels have been entered.
Yep.
And then now you have a secondary problem, right? You have a big bleeding problem, which is presumably a second concern, but it's obviously interfering with your primary concern, which is getting into the trachea. So I would generally, in an emergency setting, promote a quick vertical incision. I think if you can palpate the landmarks, that's very helpful, and use your thumb to guide you, and then get whatever tube you have. It might be a tracheostomy. It oftentimes might be an endotracheal tube.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to get something in there and start ventilating.
Right.
And are there just very kind of basic common mistakes or best practices that you would recommend above and beyond that?
Yeah, I think it's the big teaching point, I think, is keeping your cool and knowing that time will slow down in that situation. Move very quickly, but move safely, and you probably have a little bit more time than you think you do.
Yeah.
So keep your senses. Keep in mind that you're also now managing the patient. You're managing the team who's also managing the patient. And I think that's pretty critical. If you have an assistant who can retract, making sure that you have some retractor available, mm-hmm. or calling out for it. But I think, you know, just like in a code situation, right, which we've all been to, those physicians that are running the code calmly always seems to go better and have better outcomes. And I think it's no different in an airway code requiring a cricothyrotomy.
Absolutely. Great. All right. Now, let's go back to we talked about kind of the anesthesia input and role in the percutaneous tracheostomy. What if it's open in the OR? I mean, obviously, the patient is going to be asleep, and as we always do with managing patients in the OR, we will keep them safe, comfortable, and asleep. Is there anything specific to open tracheostomies that you think anesthesia providers should keep in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I'll step back too, because if you think about how frequently now tracheostomies are done with a percutaneous technique, it probably is those patients that had a contraindication for the percutaneous technique. Maybe they cannot extend their neck. Maybe they're morbidly obese or have a ton of soft tissue in their neck.
Right.
And so, or maybe they have a coagulopathy and they have to get the trach in. And so they're generally higher risk patients, not as anatomically favorable.
Yep.
And so the communication does need to be very, very close, with both the surgeon and the anesthesiologist. One of the things, especially once you get down to the trach, keeping in mind to deflate the cuff. Because if you make your incision through the trachea, you ideally don't want to cuff up.
Right.
And then you puncture the cuff and now you might have ventilatory concerns. So that's critical. Backing up the tube. I mean, same thing in the with the percutaneous technique, backing up the tube so you safely don't lose the airway.
Right.
Just in case something unexpected happens with placing the tracheostomy.
Right. Great. All right. Those are great tips. So what do you think about common complications that one might see after a trach? You know, where we may be now in the ICU or in the PACU, depending on where people go in given hospitals, with a patient who's had a tracheostomy, what should we be looking for in terms of complications?
Yeah, so I think there's probably the way to think about complications from a tracheostomy is early and late are probably the how you would categorize them. An early complication oftentimes may be related to the technique. You may see bleeding either from a clipping of a vessel in a percutaneous or open technique. A lot of times you might even have mucosal bleeding that just starts to occur. And then you enter into the issues with air tracking into compartments of the body that maybe it shouldn't. Subcutaneous emphysema, air that is under the skin. You can have pneumomediastinum, which would be air in the mediastinum, and then, you know, pneumothorax, which is really air around the lung but compressing on the lung. Mm-hmm. And so those are the critical early complications. I think early or late, there can always be a blockage of the trach, and that's important to consider. It's also the reason for the need for regular suction of tracheostomies that have just been performed.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other surgical complications of could you be injuring adjacent organs such as the esophagus, such as the great vessels.
Yep. And then are there those are all things that could happen early or early and late. And then when you think about later, and when you say late, we're talking about days down the road? Or?
Well, I think, yeah, probably more like days to weeks down the road. One would be the trach coming out, right? Decannulation or accidental decannulation. I think this is a question that's that comes up a lot. If it happens immediately, that is a significant emergency because the tract that was created or is not going to remain opened if that trach comes out. And that's the reason why we secure the trach with a tight tie around the neck and then usually with sutures through the flange or faceplate. And then those other complications that may take days to weeks, infection, tracheitis. You might get granulation tissue from the tracheostomy tube rubbing. Sometimes that can be right under the faceplate around the neck, or you can oftentimes see granulation tissue in the trachea.
Okay.
And then the windpipe itself could become injured. Maybe the cuff was overinflated and causes some injury to the cartilage, you know, which then develops into tracheomalacia. There might be injury, and a lot of times we see it above where the tracheostomy sits, a deformity causing tracheal stenosis from the tracheostomy. And now we're really entering the late or delayed complications. And then connections, right? Tracheoesophageal fistula, connection between the trachea and the esophagus, thankfully very rare. Tracheoinnominate fistula, right? The big vessel that's bringing blood from the aorta and crosses right over the front of the trachea. And in very rare cases, if there's too much pressure, especially in someone who's had radiation and which has deleterious effects on the tissue, there can be a connection between the trachea and that vessel. And that's usually life-threatening.
Yeah.
And then I think we talked about stenosis as well.
Great. All right. Now, let's say, because I think the one that, of those later complications, or I guess it could be early or late, but that potentially we would need to act on sooner rather than later would be the tube coming out, right? I mean, that could be an emergency if the patient can't ventilate without it in. So, obviously, if you can get the surgeon who just put the thing in, great, right? But if this is the middle of the night and you're the ICU resident or attending or the ER doc or whatever you are, wherever you are, and a new trach comes out, what do you do if you don't have the surgeon right there to deal with it themselves?
So then I think you have to think about what was the reason for the trach going in the first place. Hopefully this wasn't an awake trach done because of a bad obstruction at the level of the vocal cords. And what I would recommend in that situation is treat it like somebody who's got respiratory failure. You would want to bag mask them and then hopefully establish an airway from above. If there is still a small connection with air leaking out of the neck after the tube has come out, you probably want to cover that to allow for a closed circuit with the nose and the mouth.
Yep.
And in most situations, that can be that is the most efficient and easiest way to manage that.
Yeah. Now, obviously, in the setting of a total laryngectomy, that's a different issue where there is no access from above.
Right.
And in that case, you got to try to put it back in the way the trach.
Exactly. Okay. And total laryngectomy is now we're moving outside of that. You know, this is different because now you've truly disconnected the respiratory tract from the throat, from the pharynx, and there is no connection to the nose or the mouth.
Right.
There is only a connection out the neck.
Right.
And then, yes, then it must be – that's the only way to get the airway at that point.
And are there any – so let's take either that scenario or it could be that the patient had, something compressing the upper airway. That's why they got the trach. It's still there maybe. So if you feel like you can't – or let's say you try from above and you can't do it. Are there techniques? Would you try a bougie? Would you – how do you recommend people go for trying to get that trach back in the neck?
Yeah, in some situations you may be able to have a scope that can guide you there, or you're going to have to sort of rely on, your landmarks that you can palpate to get back in, because you're going to need to get back in quickly.
Yeah. So, okay, you can try a fiber optic bronchoscope if you have one. You could try a bougie and feel for those tracheal rings if you have. You try your finger.
You can try your finger, or you're now moving into the cricothyrotomy protocol.
Right. So you could still do a cric, which would be above that area. Okay, great. Let's talk briefly about cuffs. So you have a new trach, it's going to have a cuff, right? You would always have a cuffed trach at first for a variety of reasons. I imagine that helps. If there is bleeding, it's going to help keep it out of the lungs.
Right.
At what point do you take a patient? We talk a lot in the ICU, some folks may not be aware of this, about downsizing and or going to a cuffless trach. When does that happen?
Well, so I think it depends. I mean, if we think about why most tracheostomies occur, and obviously coming from the otolaryngology perspective, we are probably in the minority, right? We're doing it because for airway protection, because of a big head and neck cancer excision, or we're doing it because of some bad tracheal or laryngeal stenosis. But the majority of these cases are chronic respiratory failure.
Yeah.
And so the real benefit of the trach is it's removing dead space. It hopefully allows the patient to more easily wean from the ventilator.
Yep.
And assuming they don't need pressure support or ventilatory support, from our perspective, we would want to get that cuff down as soon as possible.
Right. Because it can cause complications by itself, like you said, tracheomalacia, et cetera.
Right. Right.
Okay.
And now with these lower pressure cuffs, just like on an endotracheal tube, we don't see that as much, but it certainly does occur. The other benefit now is once you've deflated the cuff or gotten a cuffless trach in, you can allow the patient can phonate because usually air can flow around the outside of the trachea tube within the trachea and go up through the vocal cords.
Now, sometimes that has to require a downsizing
order
for there to be
right.
So how far out, let's say a patient is, they're fine, they're breathing, not on the vent, they're just on trach collar, they're not requiring support from a ventilator. How far out from the initial surgery would you downsize a trach?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat surgeon dependent. I think it's probably a tract. You want to make sure the tract has formed or mostly formed. Some people are, you know, I generally have a rule of about 5 days.
Okay.
I think probably the range of 3 to 7 days is, you know, would be a somewhat normal range. I know that my general surgery, our general surgery colleagues will oftentimes just like to leave that trach in for a lot longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we're considering, can we get them to phone? Can we get them to communicate? So usually I would say about 5 days, plus or minus a day.
Okay.
And then we think of it downsizing as same size tube, but without a cuff.
Yep.
Because there's now less space on the outside of the tracheostomy tube, but within the trachea.
Right.
Or you can then go to a smaller tracheostomy. Especially if you're now thinking about, will we be able to decannulate the patient, remove the tracheostomy, and let them go back to breathing through their nose and mouth?
Right. Okay. So, is there, you're going to wait, you said, depending on the surgeon, anywhere 3 to 7 or more days, to change it. When it's changed that first time, let's say for you 5 days out, do you want your team to do that? Or are you comfortable with others, maybe a respiratory therapist doing it? What's the protocol?
The protocol in this hospital is that our team performs the first trach change.
Okay.
And we do it in about 5 to 7 days.
Okay.
After that, assuming it's not an upsizing, then respiratory therapy can do it.
Okay.
Personally, my personal feeling on this is that if somebody is experienced and somebody knows how to get themselves out of trouble, they are capable of doing a trach change.
Yep. Okay, great. So another thing, we sometimes have patients who get a cricothyrotomy and emergently, and now they are in the ICU. Should that patient be changed to a tracheostomy if they're going to need, I mean, if it can come out the next day, probably doesn't matter,
right.
But let's say they're going to need ongoing support. Should we keep the cric or should we revise it for a trach?
Well, I think, you know, I think there's a study, I think it came out in 2010, looking at, you know, the concept with a cric is that the longer the tube is in through the cricothyroid membrane, that it will put the patient at higher risk for stenosis.
Mm-hmm.
And in this study, they did not find high rates of stenosis. I'm not and then they therefore concluded there is not a rush to convert from a cricothyrotomy to a tracheostomy.
Mm-hmm.
I would beg to differ. I have the worst cases of laryngeal stenosis I've seen have been from crics that have either not been recognized because they're done emergently or are just left in too long.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, my personal feeling on this, and I think most otolaryngologists hew to this belief of if the tube is going to likely be in for 3 days or longer, we would say convert to a tracheostomy.
Okay.
You know, I mean, can you go to 5 days a week? Probably, but that would be the general tenet that I would promote.
Okay. So it is, if it's going to be, you know, the next day, it can come out, no problem.
Right.
Speaking of coming out, so a patient has a trach and they're doing fine. There's kind of two paths, right? One is they may not need it at all, like you said. They may be ready to breathe through their nose and mouth, in which case, is there any do you just take it out and it heals on its own? Do you need to actually apply any kind of patch to the neck? How does that heal up?
So there's a capping protocol, and which would be the best way to test, can the patient breathe comfortably without a trach, where
mm-hmm.
we basically will cap the trach. It's usually the smallest size trach that mm-hmm. we can find, most frequently a 4. And that will be put in. The patient will be capped. Our protocol within the hospital is to cap them for the day, uncap for the first night, and then the next day move to continuous capping. If they can make it for 24 hours in a row, we feel quite comfortable that the tracheostomy tube can be removed safely. And there's a good study, Vincia Pandian is the first author on that, that shows the benefits of a capping protocol and predicting who can safely be decannulated. Once you've decided to decannulate and remove the trach, there is still that hole in the neck.
Yeah.
And without pressure over the hole when talking or coughing, air is going to continue to leak out or come out. And so what we'll do is we'll create a little sort of gauze patch that's obviously bigger than the hole,
yeah.
And secure it with tape and instruct the patient to put pressure over that when talking or coughing. And usually in a matter of 3 days, maybe 7 or 8 days, that has completely healed.
Great. All right. Now, let's say a patient is going to need long-term – I mean, the most obvious example would be someone who had a total laryngectomy. At some point, they no longer need to have a cannula in there, right? They will just be able to have a stoma in the neck.
So in a total laryngectomy, yes, you can have a stoma. And the reason for that is because in a total laryngectomy, you really are suturing the tracheal rings to the skin of the neck. So there isn't going to be collapse of the respiratory tract, the new respiratory tract. A tracheostomy is a little bit different because you need to create a surgical tunnel or hole down to the from the skin down into the trachea. And without a tube, that soft tissue and skin will want to close, okay. Sort of like a PEG tube might. And so that's the reason that tracheostomies in general are tracheostomy tubes are left in those patients who maybe need it at night or need it for a long term for whatever reason.
Great. All right. So let's talk about different types of trachs. I mean, we hear a lot of a 6-0 Shiley or you mentioned a 4. Are they just different make different brands or are there different styles and how do you know who needs what?
Yeah, there are different brands and different styles. And they all have slight differences. I think if you were to break it down, the concept of a trach is to have the largest inner diameter with the smallest outer diameter, because that outer diameter is what's taking up space in the trach. It's what's going through the neck. And it's the inner diameter that you're truly breathing through. So a narrow inner diameter, it's like you're breathing through a straw. The other key parts to the trach is the cuff, as we talked about, because especially in patients who may need to inflate the cuff at night because they're on a ventilator, some people will use foam cuffs, which are generally thought to be a little bit more delicate to the adjacent tissue. And then the third key part is the faceplate or flange. Many companies have now gone towards more of a softer plastic, so it will create less irritation to the skin, less erosion or ulceration of the skin around there. And then there's the key concept of an inner cannula, which is really the whole premise behind a trach, right? It's a safe airway because there's the inner cannula that if that becomes obstructed, if the tube becomes obstructed, you can quickly remove the inner cannula and you now still have a tube that's going into the neck.
Right.
So they can breathe. And so that inner cannula and its relation to the outer cannula are pretty critical. And that's where you'll see some of the differences.
Okay.
A Bavona trach is a very flexible trach. It doesn't have an inner cannula. So the danger with the Bavona trach, you can adjust its position. As I said, it's very flexible and it will bend accordingly. But if there are secretions that build up, your only choice is to remove the whole trach in an emergency. The most common company is probably Shiley. And what's nice about their trachs is they have an inner cannula that's very tight in the outer cannula. So you sort of will help achieve that ratio or that relationship is probably a better term of larger inner cannula diameter to smallest outer cannula diameter.
Right.
And then there's the Portex trach. Also a very good trach with a very soft faceplate, but their technology doesn't seem to have as much. It's not as tight, the inner cannula going in. And then I would probably be a little remiss if I didn't mention Jackson metal trachs, which seem to be pretty rare, they're a lot less frequently used these days. Because they're really permanent, and you can take them out, you can clean them and put them back in. But in general, I think as most medical devices have moved, or I shouldn't say medical devices, most prostheses have been moved to more disposable. Mm-hmm. It's just they have sort of fallen out of favor. What's nice about the metal trach is they can be made very thinly.
Yeah.
And then they're also low profile in the neck.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's great. Now, these patients, here, certainly, I think the protocol is they always go either to an ICU or to some particular kind of step-down beds. One obvious reason it would be just if it falls out, you want to be in an acuity of level where that would be noticed quickly. Are there other reasons why these patients need to be monitored closely?
I think the most important is probably just the intensity of the nursing care in those first 24 hours.
And is that around suctioning?
Suctioning, right. And that's the big thing. You know, I think our post-op trach orders require suctioning every hour. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a PRN,
right.
So if they don't need it, we don't do it. But some patients need suctioning every hour, and that's just not something that a floor nurse can really manage.
And why is that? Why is there such a high suctioning need postoperatively?
Well, I think you've now made a connection from the outside to the inside. The tissues are apt to secrete, you know, serous fluid. Mm-hmm. In addition, you have cold air, right? The air is not going through your nose and mouth, which both heat and humidify the air.
Yep.
And through the trach tube, even with a ventilator, the air is not as warm or as well humidified. And so that creates irritation of the tracheal skin and creates more secretions.
And then over time, they adjust and it no longer...
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, great. Great
discussion. Most patients adjust.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So great discussion of tracheal surgery. Let's talk about laryngeal surgery, which I think is actually more of your personal practice. So this is now where you're operating on or very near the vocal cords themselves.
Yeah.
Often this means you can't have an endotracheal tube in place, not always, but often, while you are actually operating. So how does that work? How are we able to oxygenate and ventilate a patient when we can't have an endotracheal tube in?
Yeah, and so, you know, I think in most vocal cord or vocal fold procedures, there's probably enough space, thankfully, because the lesions of the vocal fold are so small. But I have a large surgical practice in stenosis or fibrosis of the larynx mm-hmm. or the trachea.
Yeah.
And there, in that situation, we are literally operating on the area that usually the breathing tube sits in.
Yeah.
So there's a few different ways to manage that. One is to share time between what the patient needs from an anesthesia perspective and what the patient needs from a surgeon's perspective. And so you can remove the tube and have some short period to operate, intermittent apnea or intermittent ventilation.
Yep.
And then the tube goes back in. There's also jet ventilation, which are very small. They're usually about 4 millimeter outer diameter tubes that can be placed. And as long as they don't take up space for the surgeon to operate through, you can, in most situations, ventilate the entire case. And then it's not really interfering in the surgical field.
Yep.
So that's another option. One that I've learned from an anesthesiologist actually at Bayview Hospital is something called high flow oxygen or apneic oxygenation. And I think that's had something of a renaissance recently. You see it more certainly in the ICUs, mm-hmm. With the high flow nasal cannula or yep. Thrive.
Yep.
But in the OR, I will sometimes, if I'm operating on the trachea and it's for a short case of about 30 minutes or less, I will just push high flow oxygen through a nasal trumpet in the nasal cavity. And it's usually about 12 to 15 liters per minute of 100% oxygen. And patients get enough gas exchange. Certainly the CO2 builds up during the course of the surgery. But in patients who are not obese, don't have a lot of chest mass,
yep.
and really have healthy lungs, they weren't smokers, they can get by for 30 or 40 minutes and maintain their oxygen levels,
yeah.
which in most cases is enough time for us to do what we need to do on the larynx or the trachea.
Right. And certainly, even if it's not that long, you can buy yourself more time than you would have had with
exactly.
total apnea.
Right.
Now, is the basically what you're doing is hooking up you're putting in a nasal trumpet, you're hooking up your tubing through essentially an endotracheal tube connector.
Adapter, right.
Yep, and then right. hooking that directly to the nasal cannula.
Yep.
And then giving them high flow oxygen. Now, is there any concern about airway fires pumping 100% oxygen in there or not?
Well, I think yes, certainly, and I think anytime I'm using a laser in one of my cases, we are dialing down the FiO2 to about 30%.
Yeah.
The benefit of this technique in really lowering the risk of airway fires is there's no endotracheal tube that can catch on fire
right.
and stay on fire after the initial spark.
Right.
It's still pretty low risk, but if you're using a laser and you're pushing 100% oxygen through the area that you're using the laser, you will oftentimes see these small little flares, which are best to avoid.
Yeah.
To really eliminate the risk of airway fires, which nobody likes.
Absolutely. All right. And then are there other things for anesthesiologists who are involved in these, or maybe a resident who's doing one the next day? Are there things you would recommend they keep in mind that make these surgeries go more smoothly in addition to what we just talked about with ventilating and oxygenating the patient?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a different perspective. It's a different relationship when you're the anesthesiologist working with sort of an airway surgeon or a laryngologist, right? I mean, first off, we are operating where you're used to having the patient's head.
Yep.
And right then and there, it is, you know, we're stepping on your turf. You know, the surgeon probably feels vice versa. And I think and then the other aspect to it is how closely you need to be communicating, especially if you're using one of these alternative or alternate ventilatory techniques.
Yeah.
You need to be in close communication if you're jet ventilating, because what if peak pressures are increasing, right? Then you're at a little bit of a higher risk for a pneumothorax. What if saturations are dropping? So there's really very close, you're really working together in the same area. You know, anesthesia is allowing me to operate in your sort of your realm. And then the surgeon in those cases is also pretty critical to how do you ventilate the patient safely. Yeah. I had one interesting case in a patient that I was operating on. You know, I operate on this patient every 3 or 4 months. And so I know her lung physiology, and she's somebody that we usually perform high flow oxygen on. We could never get her stats up above 95. It was an odd situation where it was myself and the anesthesiologist were discussing this. Mm-hmm. I noticed that this is not our usual respiratory physiology. And he started looking through her her medication list, because what was running through his mind was, well, maybe she's got methemoglobinemia. And sure enough, she was recently put on Dapsone.
Huh.
So I think it was a good situation. You know, I can't think of the last time an otolaryngologist helped to diagnose somebody with methemoglobinemia.
That's right.
But I think it's, you know, we're stressing the respiratory physiology in some of these cases. We're doing it safely, but we're stressing it.
Yeah.
And so I just thought that was a good example of a rare, you know, medical diagnosis that we were able to arrive at pretty quickly by, you know, through teamwork.
Communicating, yeah. So communicating, of course, always key. Certainly, as you point out, in these surgeries where we're both very, very focused on the same area,
right.
Got to have good communication. All right, great. Now, the last thing I want to ask you about is we have a system here, and I'm sure other hospitals have a similar system of emergency airway response. We call it the DART team, which stands for I don't know. What does it stand for? Do you know?
Difficult airway response
Difficult team. Airway response team. That's right. I couldn't think of the D. So the difficult airway response team. And when one calls a DART, you get both otolaryngology, anesthesia, trauma surgery. We, of course, in anesthesia, think of our role as to be to try to intubate the patient. What do you see your role there as, and what do you recommend in terms of kind of the teamwork that maximizes the benefit and the success of a DART call?
Yeah, and I'll back up a little bit in terms of this was established, I think, now about 12 years ago at our hospital due to a number of really airways that were not optimally managed, and in root cause analyses was felt that the experts in the airway, right, anesthesia, otolaryngology, trauma surgery, and when they're in the emergency room, the emergency room
yep.
attendings weren't, and certainly the highest level of each of these teams weren't arriving.
Yeah.
At the patient's bedside quick enough. So the DART sort of develops, you know, an airway response team the same way you might have a code team.
right.
going where the heart's not working. You know, since now I think there's like six or seven teams, right? We have the brain attack team yep. and there's
heart
there's,
attack team. Yeah.
Right. All sorts of teams. But now to answer your question in terms of the goal is to get the airway experts there.
Yep.
And I think fundamentally it's really anesthesia is as you said, the airway expert, right? The majority of them, especially now, if you think about the what your capabilities are with a video laryngoscope, anesthesia is able to intubate the large majority of cases. And also probably better than any – or certainly better than any other service understands the difficult airway algorithm, right? The concept of let's get LMA in, yeah. right? A laryngeal mask airway. That's part of the difficult airway algorithm.
Right.
I don't know that, I hope most otolaryngologists are thinking about that and trauma surgeons, but probably not all people are.
Yeah.
And so that's the goal. Trauma surgery, which is in-house at a faculty level, is there because they are proficient in performing a emergency surgical airway,
yep.
should it come to that. And then otolaryngology was included because they were being called, before this team was developed, they were being called for some of these difficult airways. It was before there were video laryngoscopes because of our techniques with tubed laryngoscopy,
yeah.
which is different than your blade laryngoscopy, a Miller or Mac blade,
right.
Which is helpful if there's edema in the airway or bleeding in the airway,
yep.
which is probably responsible for a significant percentage of these difficult airways.
Right.
So,
and this is like a Hollinger?
A Hollinger, right.
Hollinger okay.
Laryngoscope, which is really our sort of go-to airway laryngoscope. Yep.
And that's a tube, meaning that you actually are looking down through instead of under like we do. You're yeah. looking through a tube yeah. that it makes up the scope.
Well, it's interesting to talk to you about it's interesting you look under the Mac or Miller blade. That's
right.
how you
– Yes.
I think of it as really you have this beautiful horizon view, right? If you can get the tongue out of the way, you're seeing everything.
Yeah.
And it's this beautiful view. And we instead have this really tiny view. The Hollinger scope is actually monocular. You can't get binocular view through it.
Okay.
And so you have these small little images that of through the tube laryngoscope. Very helpful if there's bleeding.
Yep.
But not so helpful in terms of if there's difficult anatomy or to know exactly where you are. And
yep.
so you almost have to rely on your knowledge of the anatomy and how to get to the larynx. The other benefit of the Hollinger is the anterior aspect of the scope is flanged up.
Mm-hmm.
We oftentimes talk about an airway being anterior or yeah. a larynx being anterior, and this was designed with that goal of getting there in the design of the scope.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, if you can just place it, it's going to guide you where yeah. you need to be. Once you have that Hollinger laryngoscope, if you have it at your institution, most breathing tubes don't fit through it. So you've now exposed the larynx, but you're going to now have to figure out how you get a definitive airway there.
Yeah.
We will oftentimes use a bougie.
Yeah.
Right. Or, and that bougie is placed through the Hollinger laryngoscope. The laryngoscope is then removed. So there's this 20-second period where everybody's wondering, do we really have an airway?
Right.
And then the endotracheal tube is advanced over the bougie.
Yep. Okay. So that's a nice technique. So, I think from my experience, and I think you'd probably agree, that the nice thing about these DART team calls is that you get the experts there, and then, sometimes you don't have any time, but often you do, and you can kind of come up with a plan. If the issue is, and often it is, we don't know for sure, but it might be a really difficult airway, or there's a history of it, but we don't know what it's going to be like this time, then often it's the anesthesiologist will take a look, and if they can get it in, then great. But if not, then you've got the backup right there, which might be, and it depends on the patient, you taking a look with the Hollinger, and if that doesn't work, the trauma surgeon doing the Craig.
Right.
Right. And so you, but you've got all of that ready to go.
And what's more, I think having multiple minds, as long as they're communicating well, right? And we talk about this a lot
yes.
with our respective residents. As long as they're communicating well, they are they're enhancing than what one mind
right.
is going to do. So I think you nail it on the head in terms of the benefits of such a team, especially when they're working in concert.
Right. And the other thing I would say is that there's often, I think, some reluctance, especially in young providers, whether that's a resident or a new junior attending, to call a DART because they it almost in some ways like feels like an admission of not being confident in your own skills, especially on the anesthesia side, right? We're supposed to be able to do the intubation, so to call a DART is almost like admitting failure. But I would say I got over that really quickly. And it is so – I would say if you're in doubt, it's much better to call the DART team and not need it than to realize after you've tried and failed the intubation that now you need to call it and wait 5 minutes while you're desperately trying to oxygenate a patient who you may not be able to oxygenate. So if you're unsure and you have a system like this, take advantage, call it. I've never had a trauma surgeon or an otolaryngologist show up and say, well, Paul, what are you doing? Why'd you call me? Right? People are happy to be there and lend their expertise or just be on standby in case it doesn't go well.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's funny hearing you say that. It's taken me a number of times to also put that in my algorithm, right? Like it might be one of my patients and I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm the difficult airway expert in otolaryngology. I'm here, but now the first thing I do is say, let's call a DART.
Yeah.
And it's helpful.
Very helpful. No question about it. And the last thing I want to say is that you and I kind of collaborated on something that's been really interesting and successful, which is an elective where we've had our residents go to your clinic and get to do some kind of high volume practice in awake laryngoscopy, something that you guys do all the time. And what we found is that our residents find this really useful to help them learn the anatomy and the approach to awake intubation, something that just happens less and less because, as you mentioned, with video laryngoscopy, it's just less common that we have to do an awake intubation. And so I would suggest for anyone out there thinking about this kind of thing, get your ENT and your anesthesia folks together and think about doing this. We found it really successful and a real benefit. And I think both the otolaryngologists and the anesthesiologists have found this to be a neat, fun collaboration.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that completely.
Great. Well, Zandy, thank you so much for coming on the show and for being a great colleague.
Thanks for having me, Jed.
All right. That was fantastic. Thank you, Zandy. I hope everyone found that as useful as I did. Go to the website, acrac.com. Let us know what you thought. If you are often in these surgeries or you have questions that weren't answered, let us know. If you have thoughts on different ways to do this, different ways to do a crike, let us know so we can all learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show, even if you've already done it. If it's been a little while, you can go back and do it again. It does count again. And if you're interested in supporting the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. If you prefer to make a pledge when and where you want, you can go to paypal.me/acrac. That's paypal.me/accrac, and you can make a donation in any amount at any time that you'd like. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much to all of you who are already patrons or already have made donations. We really appreciate it. All right. That's it for today for the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Zandy Hillel. I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.